I'm Tom Metzger, your host for Race and Reason. Race and Reason, that show dedicated to free speech, that small island of free speech in a sea of controlled and managed news. Today our guest is Richard Cotton, longtime activist in the anti-communist nationalist movement, 25 years in the movement, and he's here today to talk to us about what you're up to now, Richard.
Well, thank you, Tom. Well, I hope for a reactivation of conservative viewpoint as it was in the 60s and somewhat into the 70s, both radio broadcast and newsletter to accompany it. Started out Christ and the Constitution and gradually evolved toward, have we, the men of the West, lost the will to live? That's Dr. Oliver's famous quote and carried on my letterhead.
I see you've had so many things in your past here. You've got sort of a whole lot of these things on this paper right here. And gee, I look across here and I see you with Ian Smith, the late leader of Rhodesia, and down here with some black people from Africa. And I see that there are a lot of articles here that are really giving you a rough way to go and everything. You've really earned your wings, haven't you? I mean,
well, Tom, you and I've worked a similar vein for something like 20 years, I think. I believe my beginnings were 25 years now. And if there has been a high point, and I'd like to comment on it a little bit, the broadcast magazine, Centerfold, Richard Cotton backed FCC into a corner.
And now, you were on about 25 shows at one time.
Oh, yes, yes. We bought our own time. We're known coast to coast. I'm a Southern colonel, filled a civic auditorium in New Orleans, and similarly took on the battles for the white Southerner some years ago. So at times I got quite controversial, and actually it was radio station KTYM, Inglewood, California, where Mr. Williams had the courage to carry my broadcast. And the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith took the FCC to court, wanted them to lose their license, their right to license, because they had dared to carry my so-called blatant anti-Semitism.
Gee, they're still at it today. They've been working on me, too.
Well, Tom, it was interesting to be talked about and not to. It happened I was traveling in the Middle East at the time, and I came back and sat in court in Washington, D.C., and the man who presided in that U.S. District Court of Appeals, three-man court, of course, was Berger. And in time, they wrote an opinion that should have been landmark and should have heralded a whole new era. Essentially, Berger said that although some may find Mr. Cotton's views objectionable, America was best served if he was heard from. So I am in my own, I quip that I'm the only licensed bigot in the nation.
How come we never saw those in big headlines, Cotton wins in Washington, huh?
What happened following that tells a lot about the state of freedom of speech in America. My station's virtually without exception said, Richard, we're glad you won. We like your broadcast. We know you to be honest, factual, and so on. You can come on the air as long as you don't say Jew, Israel, or Zionist.
Free speech, but, huh?
Well, the sad part is the station doesn't have the ability to protect himself, Tom, as you well know. The advertising dollars that are his source of revenue keep his doors open, center in acceptance by this underground police operation of theirs, and they can shut that station down.
So, really, our gripe should be that I think under those conditions these people lost the right to even administer the airways, these people in Washington. Maybe we should have pirate radio stations all over the country. What do you think?
A few years ago in the early 60s, you know, we were going to have ships lying offshore, and I think some of that was tried in the Caribbean even. One way or another, pamphleteering or what have you, we have to reach the public with the facts. I think as this South African affair comes into focus and more of our white racist people understand the threat is real, I think we can reach them. We have good sound premises to work from, and we need the means of doing it. If cable television can do it, let's get on cable.
Is there a silver lining in the South African struggle?
I support Mr. S.E.D. Brown of the South African Observer. I've been a guest in his home when I've been in Pretoria and when I lectured in Cape Town and so on. He writes a very, very informative and useful paper. In fact, he does the best job in the world of tying the Anti-Defamation League, Tel Aviv, and Moscow, and so on together. I'm proud to promote his works. he has not painted as optimistic a picture as an Afrikaner, whom I recently have been conversing with, who feels that despite all the press to the contrary, the white will stand shoulder to shoulder and will take his country back. The black does not constitute a threat. I would say the threat comes from the United States rather than the black in Africa.
I find it interesting, reading the financial pages, though, that South Africa's economy is much stronger than it was before. It seemed like ever since they started their sanction bit, they've grown stronger. Is there a possibility that there's a big scam on to where one group is manipulating to make a lot of money off this deal? I mean,
Tom, I don't have the answers. I do know the same people own the press, I can't understand why the Afrikaner allows the international Jew to control his press, but he does, just as we do in the United States.
Now, in Rhodesia, I remember at one time when things were really getting rough over there that there was a very large exodus of Jewish people. And now I've seen that there's getting to be a larger exodus of Jewish people out of South Africa. Is that the signal that, hey, guys, it's about ready to blow?
I think they... I don't have an inside track on that, Tom. I do know they have... I can think of instances in which the Jew says how unconscionable it is to suggest that he is any part of the revolutionary movement, and yet there they are headlined in every subversive movement.
But aren't they split down the middle, though, on South Africa? Because Israel has been the conduit for South African products into Europe, and they work together, they build arms for each other, all this kind of stuff.
Because of the monetary control of South Africa in the hands of the Jews, and, of course, Israel in the hands of the Jews, that was in harmony. I don't think the white South African was a part of it, but I don't think he's any smarter about how to handle it than we have been in the United States.
But who are the... there's a lot of white Anglo-Saxon, Aryan elitists in big business down there. Now, this can't be all a Jewish situation.
No,
is it just
no.
like the old days when the British wanted to stomp the Boers out? Is it a white civil war again? I see all of it's white Anglo-Saxons and Aryans that are really attacking them even bad or worse than the Jews.
Reading your own writings, Tom, and seeing your own paper, I think you're pretty close to the truth in the matter of the truly international industrialist who is... He does not reflect his white race at all. He's only interested in his international community. And I think we should fear him or fight him, call it whatever you want, just as much as we do the Jewish element.
Now, you created the White Solidarity Movement here just a few years ago. That has a good ring to it.
I learned a lot about human nature out of that, Tom, and I should have realized our limitations in it. It was an effort to bring all the people in the various so-called conservative movements. I don't care for the word, but I don't know just what to use at this point. Those who fight for their country, more or less in the pure constitutional form which our forebears created for us. And I found them lacking one house organ, so to speak, and I pictured a blanket organization, and everybody support this, and in our magazine would be articles by you, Tom, and let's say Klan, and let's say the Citizens Council, and Minutemen, and so on. But as I tried to bring these leaders together, and they showed me the courtesy of meeting, gets right down to dollars and cents. They have to survive. Their mailing list is their lifeblood. And I can't think the less of them if they want to protect that from any pooling. So the White Solidarity Movement, for lack of that concept, it didn't really get... it died a mourning, but I think it's more timely than ever, Tom. Somebody's strong enough to carry it. And whether it's White Solidarity Movement or your suggestion, White Solidarity Party, word solidarity has a good ring. It's like Minutemen. You can't damage the word solidarity.
You know, going back there just a few paragraphs, I find it interesting that people would tend to say, well, you know, they couldn't combine and work together because of losing a certain amount of income. Now, I, as an individual, have, ever since I've been in this movement, I've held down a job. I have a business of my own. I've never lived off any movement. And I've been able to get as much done, I think, as just about anybody else. So I find it hard to believe that these white Aryan great guys around a country cannot make a living and still fight this battle.
Tom, you're a singularly successful example of that. I was telling my granddaughter today of something of your background. I know your business enterprise, and I know you support yourself and are in this movement, too. You are exemplary in that, and I think almost unique.
I don't think it needs to necessarily everyone has to do it that way, but I do believe it shows example of the strength of a small businessman to have an art, yeah, to have a gift or whatever it may be. That and then you're always showing by example to people who come on. When people come up to me and say, "Tom, I just can't. I can't just work this hard. I can't sacrifice. I can't do this. I can't. I don't have enough time." And I say, "What are you talking about? Well, look at what we do, and we do it with a shoestring."
And Tom, the best I know, you have your same phone number, same address, and you're a successful businessman in a small California community.
10,000 hate calls later. I still have the same phone number.
We can learn from that.
But anyhow, the white solidarity movement is definitely something that has to be, whether it be a pan-Aryanist idea, working with groups from other countries and so forth.
Well, we certainly have a right to think of our own interest, and this doesn't say there's any reason the other man shouldn't, but surely the black organizes for his interest, the Hispanic and so on. All right. Where is the organization deeply dedicated and interested in the survival of the white race and the betterment of the white race? And why do we become racist when the other man is, of course, simply supportive?
Well, I believe we're sabotaged. Yes. I believe we're sabotaged by the elitists of our own race who do not want us to succeed in straightening out our problem. I believe that any time we try to get something moving, the rich man's press, the rich man's church, or whatever it may be, steps in to squash us.
Most of our people don't seem to be able to think for themselves. I watch now this charade as the Congress demands that South Africa, the whites, be exterminated. That's the bottom line. There's no way they're going to share power in South Africa. And those men are race traitors in every sense of the word and should be called for accounting, if no other way, in the ballot box. But it's the popular thing to do, a peculiar position in which you found the president trying to stand out for apartheid, which in essence is separate development. We have separate development in Arizona. I live in Scottsdale. There the Indians have a separate development and demand it, and our government fawns on them as it establishes their separate boundaries and gives them more largesse. But in South Africa, where the white man who built a civilization has the audacity to say, "I want a nation of my own," we purport to think that's
well,
acceptable.
They want majority rule in South Africa and minority rule here.
Yes, very glaring inconsistency.
And it's interesting to see all these college-educated people using that kind of logic.
Well, Tom, I would ask you, how well are you doing on the campuses? Because surely that's where we have to make
them headway. I do very well on the campuses when I can get on the campuses. But for the ever since the 1980 election, when I sort of made an end run on them, they have been very reticent about bringing me onto the campuses, and they use the excuse that there may be violence. Well, of course, that's always a self-serving situation. So when I am on a campuses, and even in the high schools, I do very well with the young people because I don't pull any punches, and I don't say that we're all right and all that, but we shouldn't have this guilt trip that we're saddled with. I think I do very well, and I think you could do extremely well because you're just as handsome as ever. 25 years later, you know, tell you.
I don't know, Tom. But it has been an exciting 25 years. Let me preface this in a way, my own testimony. I started as a committee for Christian laymen of Kern County. There were two granddaughters of Methodist circuit riders, and they were deeply appalled to see what was happening in their church, where a liberal minister, plus the liberal curriculum was unbelievable in the Methodist church. And they would try to bring this to attention to the community, and they looked a little ridiculous. So lo and behold, Richard came along and started the Committee of Christian Laymen of Kern County. Well, I began fighting the Federal Reserve. I fought against race mixing. I fought goodness knows what all. And in time, that became a smaller part of my work, particularly after I did the broadcast Nordic and Proud of It. That was kind of a turning
point. That's a hot number.
The book by Richard Hoskins on our Nordic race, it opened my eyes to the implication of what the white race had done in terms of civilization and the world. And so I left it to others, and a couple I shouldn't have left it to carry on in the that vein.
Well, you were a pioneer. I mean, just amazing. Look at all these organizations, including the Birch Society, all these organizations. They were putting out millions of dollars worth of books that many of them were never read. They never really got mass distribution. You were pioneering radio, and that's where they should have all been. Well, now we're in TV now, and yeah. So you should be, you're going to get right into there too,
well,
right?
I hope so. I had an interesting encounter with the Birch Society that you may recall, Tom. It didn't take me too long. Somebody had me read Iron Curtain Over America by Beatty.
That's a no-no.
That's a no-no.
You're not supposed to read that book.
So I read that, and I called Dan Smoot of the Smoot Report, at that time supported by D.B. Lewis of Dr. Ross Cat and Dog Food, as you know. And I said, Dan, I have just read Iron Curtain Over America. Is it true? And if so, what are we going to do about it? And I'll never forget to my dying day his reply, Richard, when all of America knows what you know now, we'll know what to do about it. And so for 25 years, I've tried to tell America what I gleaned from that one reading of Iron Curtain Over America. And I want to share it. And I can't help but think that reasoning men, fully informed, we will know what to do. We don't have to now say what we're going to do then. We need to get our ranks together.
Yeah, that was a banned book by the Birch Society, you know.
Well, Robert Welch put out a six-point bulletin saying, as you well know, we never denounce anybody working our side of the street, but Mr. Cotton's different. Because I was not afraid of the Anti-Defamation League of Benai Brith. Maybe I wasn't very smart, but I went at him directly. I met Senator Tenney, by the way, Senator Jack B. Tenney, and he, of course, was the chairman of the California Investigative Committee, finding out about all subversive forces. And, of course, the Jews helped him. They helped him fight the Nazis and helped him fight the fascists. But all of a sudden, he kept finding all these Jews at communist meetings. So the rabbis called on him and said, hey, you're going to have to lay off our boys. Mm-hmm. Well, long story short, he was martyred, as far as I'm concerned. He was a fine congressman, fine senator. And he wrote Zion's Fifth Column and other books that I read. I came to know him and admire him enormously. His walkthrough of the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, their headquarters in Los Angeles, priceless paper. I excerpt it, Tom, and you can have a stack of them and make it easy. But the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, to understand what this Gestapo-like or KGB-like organization does in America, that one little pamphlet will acquaint anyone. His daughter, who was a liberal assemblywoman here in California, came to appreciate her father, and she took his collective works and condensed it into the book Cry Brotherhood. Now, Cry Brotherhood, if I'm able to do so, will be back in print very shortly. This is to inform the people of the nature of the Anti-Defamation League and how it does work.
It's amazing how few people know of the tremendous sacrifices of literally hundreds of patriotic Americans ever since the turn of the century. Sort of a wasteland of bleached bones of people who have sacrificed everything for their country and their race. And how few people even know who they were.
Well, I was sound asleep during the McCarthy hearing, so I'm not really an old-timer. All I know is his jowls look blue-black. And, of course, I didn't know about the power of the television camera to distort at that time. So I can't say that I was born with this knowledge, but I did cut my eye teeth fighting the communists, so to speak, in the early 60s. And since that time, once it was revealed to me the nature of the Anti-Defamation League and their hold in the world Zionist conspiracy, I've been busy.
Then you begin to find out who the communist employers were in New York City. Huh?
It's been a fascinating quarter of a century, and I don't think I'm through, Tom. It's very encouraging to me to see that you're here and that I'm here, and indeed this media, plus the home VCRs and goodness knows what all we're going to be doing in the future.
Well, we've survived. That's the main thing. I mean, I hear people say, you can't say that, and gee, they're going to kill you, and this and they're this, but we just keep moving along, and I guess we're sort of an embarrassment to some of the closet racialists around who are scared to come out and do anything.
Well, there's some fine men out there, and you know a good many of them. I've heard Dr. Pierce's name mentioned on your program. I know him well, and I've watched him through the years. Go way, way back with him, as I do with many. Liz Dilling was a personal friend. Her book, Plot Against Christianity, how any of these brainwashed so-called Christians who listened to Robertson and Falwell and Swaggart, it's their first loyalty to quote-unquote Israel. It's totally at variance with Christ's teachings.
You know, on Elizabeth Dilling, too, there's hardly anyone realizes what a small group of people, even during the height of the Second World War, were against the war, were fighting against it, and were saying these things. What a tremendous courage it took during that time when we were at war to still say the king is nude, so to speak.
Well, Liz was locked up, as was Hudson, as was Van Heining, and all these other wonderful patriots. The only thread they had in common was they had brains enough to see that we were fighting a war for the Jews. And the sedition trial, published, I think, by the Lutheran Society, whatever that was, out of print now, as far as I know. Anyone read that sedition trial, it's and not know that she should be honored. I knew Liz well. I've been her house guest. In fact, I was on, I don't know if we have time for this one, a little homely.
Yeah, sure.
Jerry Williams was host on a talk show, WBBM in Chicago, covered about 30 states. I was on there for my first time, and it was stacked as usual, 3-1. We had the host, Jerry Williams. We had a Catholic interracial priest of some sort, and we had the guy that wrote Anne Frank's diary. And to set the mood for the thing, I said I was glad to meet him because I knew blame well she hadn't written it. And for 3 hours, we went hammer and tongs. And on this, it was just a little insight, but the host wanted me to say that I thought Eisenhower was a Jew. I said, I don't know if he's a Jew. He said, I thought Rockefeller was a Jew. I said, I don't know if Rockefeller was a Jew. Anybody with these names, he wanted to say that I was saying that this proved that I thought they were Jews, which was not so. So long story short, at a given point, I got tired of this, and I said, well, now, Jerry, my name's Cotton, and my daddy's name's Cotton. Now, your name's Williams. What's your daddy's name? Well, he went absolutely schizoid right in front of his own his own show. And it was a call-in show, and for months thereafter, people would call him and then say, Jerry, what's your daddy's name? One day he lost his cool entirely and shouted back into his own mic, Finkelstein, Finkelstein, Finkelstein. So we've had some high points through the years.
Why is that? That, you know, a lot of people happen to be Jewish. They sure like to change their names a lot.
Well, Tom, I challenge the Jew who purportedly is the good American, anti-Zionist, anti-this and anti-that, stand up and be counted. Benjamin Friedman did. His book, Facts Are Facts, is as factual as anybody could ask for.
Yeah, an excellent book.
But he denounced everything, including the Babylonian Talmud, which, of course, Christ denounced as the tradition of the elders. And it should be offensive to have any organization called Christian and Jew. There is no such thing as Judeo-Christian. If anybody wants the proof of that, I'll furnish it in depth.
All right.
Rabbi after rabbi saying so,
of course. We'll be running your address at the end of the show.
So where are the Jews who want to say, hey, I'm a good American, and this is the nature of what we profess to believe? And I don't see that very often. I did see it in Benjamin Friedman, whom I knew, and rather respected, but he was still what he was.
What do you see coming up, Richard? I see positive things on the horizon,
oh, yeah,
if you look at it a certain way. I always keep saying, if you look at it as a conservative, it's a little bleak, but if you look at it as a revolutionary, things look great. What do you think about that?
Well, whatever will enhance a racial consciousness, Tom. Somebody alluded to a television show in which a chap from Miami Vice, colored fellow, Puerto Rican, whatever the deuce he is, mulatto of some sort, was marrying a girl whose child had been fathered by her Nordic husband. That is extremely offensive to me, and I can't picture exactly what I would do in that circumstance. I know what any quote-unquote red-blooded American with any racial consciousness would do beyond any doubt. I know that that marriage was illegal in every state in the Union just a few years ago. And now, purportedly, we have some latter-day revelation that makes it repugnant to suggest that you not have an interracial marriage. Well, quite the contrary. It is an offense, certainly to me and certainly to
Isn't
God,
it interesting,
as I understand it.
How it's okay to be offensive to us? We have no rights not to be offended, but everyone else has the right not to be offended by us. Isn't
well, Tom,
that interesting?
How often do we say and do we forget we are the minority? We are the only significant minority in the face of the globe with a wit enough to be a threat to this conspiracy. We are less than 6%, and in our pure form, probably a great deal less than that. Our genes carry the ability to build a civilization and create a civilized world. And now we are being destroyed by an understandable program. It's quite clear once you penetrate the mechanism. And our people simply seem to be sheep. Well, more power to you and what you're trying to do. I'll be doing my...
Well, you started here in Kern County, right here, hometown boy in Southern California.
Yes.
You went over to Washington, D.C.
Called a big bad bigot from Bakersfield in jest. But I did... I fought everything, including the Birch Society, which, of course, couldn't stand the fact that I seemed to find something wrong in Zionist conspiracy. And that continues to this day. I went national. I moved to Louisiana so I could champion the Southerner.
Oh, you were in Louisiana.
Back in the days of the reverse freedom rides. Mm-hmm. And Ned Touchstone of the Citizens Council was sending possum up to Hyannis for oh, that was another war entirely.
And then you moved on, and now you moved to the Arizona area.
I headquartered in Washington, D.C. for over 12 years using Dulles Airport as my address. To this day, two words, Cotton Dulles, reaches me, which is kind of nice. And now I'm in, I hope, well, it's the land of my birth, by the way, Phoenix.
Richard? It's good to have you, and we wish you great success in 25 more years of this battle, or more.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And thank you out there. Tom Metzger, your host on Race and Reason. Race and Reason, dedicated to freedom of speech, that small island of freedom of speech in a sea of managed and controlled news. And now I welcome my co-host, Tom Padgett, who will introduce our guest.
Thank you, Tom. On my right is Pedro Garcia, who is a California delegate of the organization SEDATI, which is a white Hispanic organization dedicated to promoting the interest of white Hispanics. Pedro, welcome to the show.
I'm most honored to be here, Tom.
Hello, Pedro. Let's talk about SEDATI. Where is the headquarters of SEDATI? Is it a national, international organization?
We're an international national socialist organization based in Barcelona, Spain, for white people of Hispanic origin and or Hispanic culture. We have, based in Barcelona, Spain, we have delegations throughout South and Central America, as well as in Mexico, and now three here in the United States. And our main delegation being Miami, we have one in New York, and since 1984, we've had our delegation here in Southern California.
You never hear of the delineation between true white Hispanic and people of color that they call Hispanics. Why is that?
You see, Tom, the term Hispanic is the most misconstrued term in our current socio-political vocabulary since World War II. Let me set the record straight. The term Hispanic means white European person emanating from the Iberian Peninsula, i.e. Spain and Portugal. Now, the the news media, the educational media in this country promoting this word Hispanic, this term, since at least since the 60s, has erroneously put the label Hispanic on any person of any race who happens to speak the Spanish language or be from a former Spanish colony. You have mestizos, persons of Indian Spanish blood, majority of people in Mexico and Central America being called Hispanic, who have little or no Spanish blood. You even have Negroes, blacks.
Aren't they referred to as Zambos in South America?
Yeah, and many other terms. There's the term Hispanic is so wrongly applied. It's to say again, Hispanic is someone of European blood from the Iberian Peninsula. Mm. You never, for example, see a black Haitian called a Frenchman. You never see a black from the Congo, from Nigeria, being called an Englishman. I mean, it's only Hispanic, which is misused and applied to persons of color who happen to speak the Spanish language. And it's whole part of my mission in out here in California, as well as our other delegates in this country, to clarify that.
I think it's good that we clarify it.
Well, what kind of program? This is quite an undertaking you have here, Pedro. What are some of your ideas on reaching other white Hispanics with this?
Well, we have different tactics in Spain and in every different country. Our main modus operandi is the dissemination of information in the countries we're in. We encourage our delegates to be familiar with the political, sociological situation in the country mm-hmm. in which they live. And first of all, we encourage disseminating this information among white Hispanics, wherever, whatever part of the world they might be in. Number one, to create a sense of identity, which is the biggest problem. Many, for example, many white Hispanics, true Hispanics in this country, don't even think of themselves as white. They think of themselves as of a different race right. than their Anglo brother in this country. This is very disgusting in my point of view.
Now, in Central America and South America, it seems to be quite a bit different from what I can see. There seems to be more of a racial identity among white Hispanics.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the general dislike of white people among the mestizo Mexicans in Mexico is so strong that the same hatred is applied to the Hispanic, the true Hispanic, by the mestizo political leaders and population, as is applied to the quote-unquote gringo. The word hidalgo in Mexico is the term used by in Mexican society to differentiate Hispanics from mestizos. And there's a strong anti-white bias in the Mexican government, a strong effort to eradicate everything Spanish and everything white, and they're pushing, for example, Indian names on white people, or removal of Christian names.
What about every year we have this festival, this Mexican liberation, what's it called?
Cinco de Mayo.
The thing that amazes me about Cinco de Mayo is that it's a celebration, from my history book tells me, of thousands of mestizos that were able to corner a small group of white French troops in Mexico and annihilate them, similar to what happened to the white people at the Alamo. But yet you see millions of Americans and Anglo-Saxons, Teutonic people, running out to celebrate this annihilation of white people. It seems sort of a perversion of... sort of strange. What do you think about that?
Even more disgusting in Mexico, you see white people, including the current white president of Mexico, as well as white people of French, Spanish, and German descent in Mexico, out whipping it up for the a true act of genocide. Cinco de Mayo celebrates the brutal wanton slaughter of white women and children of French and primarily French and Spanish descent in Mexico, and our organization finds that truly appalling. We're trying we have such a challenge, and not only in this country, but going everywhere, to just create a sense, before even pride, a sense of identity among Hispanic people.
That seems like operating in Central America and in Mexico, it seems like your organization might feel a bit beleaguered down there. What kind of government repression, if any, have you run into by some of these countries?
Well, and I hate to just talk about Mexico, but where I've had much experience there, Mexico has similar hate laws as Canada. You can't openly distribute literature defaming any quote-unquote group. Our people, some of our people have been in prison, have been harassed, even killed by, at least we believe, by authorities in that country, and our group suffers extreme repression in Mexico, and it's unfortunately in our mother country, Spain, it's getting that way too, with more hate laws emanating from the International Genocide Convention.
Now, it's my understanding that a lot of Aryan Spanish people served valiantly with the forces of the German army during World War II. What is the history of the involvement of white Aryans there?
Well, there's always been a kind bond between white Spanish people and German people ever since the Holy Roman Empire, when we shared we shared the crown at one time. But to get to more recent times, when the international Bolshevik conquest took place in Spain in the late 30s, a communist-dominated government which was slaughtering thousands of people, destroyed half the churches and everything. The Germans, the Luftwaffe, Goering dispatched his Condor Division, Spanish people, some that knew very little about Adolf Hitler and National Socialism, immediately felt a bond, strong bond and friendship and gratitude with the German people for that action. Ultimately, in World War II, when Hitler's heroic crusade to wipe out Bolshevism in the East took place, the Wehrmacht asked for a division of Spanish volunteers. This was organized, recruited primarily in Spain through the Falange, which was the a nationalist party in Spain, the party which had unified the people behind Franco and the nationalists at the time, the party of José Antonio, its founder. The Blue Division served valiantly on the Eastern Front. Over 40,000 Spaniards, Spanish men and women, participated in this struggle. Almost 300,000 wanted to enlist. However, the treacherous action of Franco at the time was somewhat understandable under pressure of the Allies, was not to allow that many people to be involved in this effort.
Isn't that tremendous, that this Waffen-SS concept of hundreds of thousands, in many cases, of people from all the different nations around Europe formed in this gigantic army against Soviet communism. And it's amazing, and they get virtually no credit whatsoever. Wouldn't it be great if we could muster that kind of force today against our opposition?
Maybe we will someday, Tom. Maybe we will.
That's the primary goal, ultimate goal of SEDATI, is to work in conjunction with other white revolutionary nationalist organizations and build a front to reestablish, first of all, Aryan control of the United States, of Europe, of Latin America, at least of countries where whites are the majority, and to strongly protect the rights of white people in those countries where they're a small minority, and of course, and
bringing it back to a lighter note, you know, that's often questioned about this Hispanic thing. Like you're finally putting a straight on. I see all these young ladies in the beauty contest from South America, and I look at a lot of the imported Spanish-speaking television from South America, and there's all these brunettes and blonde-haired girls and blue-eyed and the most beautiful Aryan girls in many cases you'll see any place in the world.
How about the billboards?
Yeah.
You see that too. It's quite the
right prop. And still the television, at least, is dominated by Aryan whites in many countries in South America.
Yeah, well, and anywhere, any part of the world that's among non-white races, they naturally look with envy upon the white woman, and the white human being in general is the most beautiful creature on the face of this earth, which is even in the Philippines, for example, when there's a small group, community of Spaniards there. I mean, in the commercials over there, you see whenever they can, they get them to be the models, you know, advertise the cars or whatever. It's, I believe, despite their hatred for whites based on jealousy, the other races of the world also have, it's a love-hate relationship, have a tremendous admiration.
Well, this leads me to a question that I was wondering, as we're saying, we know that there are white Hispanics, and we know that there are a lot of non-white Hispanics. And I'm sure that as with any group of people, you have the old wannabe syndrome of, well, maybe I'm not totally white, but I'm an Hispanic, so can I get in? And we see this here in the white nationalist movement in this country, where there's someone that's perhaps not altogether white, but they're willing to do a good job or come in. And I don't think the question in this country has been resolved. How do you, or how does Sadati feel about these types that aren't totally white? Can they get in? What's the story on that? Where do you draw the line, in other words?
Our organization is exclusively for Hispanic people and no one else. However, we do cooperate with other individuals, other groups that are working for similar goals. Uh-huh. For instance, in this country, we go along with cooperation with Louis Farrakhan and such groups here in Mexico and other places. We cooperate with certain Catholic groups which are led by non-whites, but which expose the Jew and what the Jews are doing around the world. If we have an issue in common, or if we agree on a lot of issues, we can work together. But our membership, we try most strongly to limit to strictly European people. Now, if somebody has a drop of Indian blood, maybe several generations back, well, we look at the person, we look at the parents, the grandparents, whenever we can, and generally base it on the appearance of the individual.
Now, let's get to National Socialism, which is partly a racial view and partly economics and so forth. What do you see as a national socialist program for Hispanic whites or any other whites in this modern day? How would that reveal itself? How would that operate in our society?
We see national socialism as the only true revolution of the 20th century, the only true revolution for white people, the only only type of system which is totally white and is creates an environment by for which white people can live. We favor a unification with other national socialist organizations, movements around the world, with a goal of establishing something that was envisioned by people like Leon Degrelle and somewhat by our leader Adolf Hitler in the toward the latter years of the war, of a unified Europe, along with a unified white world. We envision a confederation of white Aryan republics under the general rule philosophy of national socialism, and we favor such in countries where whites are not the majority. We believe this world national socialist confederation must do everything to protect the rights of these people.
General Leon Degrelle, the hero of the war on the German side, has become a citizen of Spain. He's lived there very peacefully and very highly respected for many years. Was a tremendous radical in Belgium before he became involved during the war with the German forces. And he was brought Belgium to its knees for several months on a work stoppage. And his big thing was fighting what he called the banksters. The very term banksters evidently was created by Leon Degrelle. So as a National Socialist, evidently you're attacking these extreme capitalist forces in the same vigor you are the communist Marxist forces?
Absolutely. Our enemy is what we consider the octopus. In the center of the center is the Jew with his arms of both communism and capitalism, which are the same system. Ultimately, each system is of Jewish origin. Each system perpetuates ultimately the misery of the majority of the population, the world's population, in the hands of a few, which are usually international Jews, and we go at the whole octopus and destroy the octopus, both his right arm of capitalism and his left arm of Bolshevism. We are neither a rightist nor leftist. We are revolutionary. We work for an age when a new order is established.
What do you see? What about the Judification, if you would use that word, of the Aryan people? There's such a, I mean, you know as well as I do that things have deteriorated so far at this point that so many Aryans in this world, you can't tell them from many of these Zionist people, and they act the same, they talk the same, and they sell us all out. Has National Socialism had that traditional problem since its inception?
Absolutely, and National Socialism, its more revolutionary stage was just in Germany in the 20s. As you probably know, it's just as strongly opposed by the old Catholic and Prussian aristocrats as it was by the left. It was only later on when the Krupps, the Thyssen, and the Farben saw their only means to survive would be to go with the will of the people as opposed to their own selfish interest. Were they able to make some type of peace with the movement? But National Socialism is equally opposed to capitalism as it is opposed to communism. We favor private property, the ability as many people to own property as possible, and free enterprise. However, only to the extent that free enterprise as a system works in the interest of the state. Which is the people. The state is the people in a true national socialist state.
What about the ecology and things along this line?
Sedati is, that's a, in fact, in our so-called manifesto, which he recently translated, published into English. I should have one here. Ecology is, ecology is most important plank of our movement. We're opposed to unregulated use of nuclear energy, nuclear power. We're opposed to, in general, to private capitalist control of nuclear power. We're opposed to slaughter of animals, to game hunting. We favor very stiff laws against people, penalties against punishment for people who damage our environment. We see the without a pure environment, there's the white man, the greatest creature on the earth, really has no place to live.
You have a poster there. Let me see. Why don't we hold up that poster? Tom, you got, what have you got here for us?
Yeah, we descend.
Jump in there,
Tom. Hold on, let me help out with this here. Here we go.
Now, this one of your political posters.
In Spain and Mexico and other places, we're very big on posters. Posters are not, you don't have the kind of bulletin boards, billboards that you do in this country, but around the universities, around the public buildings, everything. We push plaster these all over, and they're very popular with the young people.
How about showing us some of the other publications you have?
First of all, this is our monthly publication magazine from from Barcelona. It's published monthly. It comes out monthly or bi-monthly. It's offered for $20 a year. Each delegation generally has their own publication.
Well, we can't get into how much money and where to send the money because that's against the rules on public access.
The address will appear at the end of the show.
Your address will appear at the end of the show.
Each delegation publishes its own bulletin or newsletter. This is ours right here, which we've disgracefully got behind on.
And so you do have members here in Southern California.
Yes, we do, and we're growing. We're reaching more people, and we're upsetting a lot of people in the establishment.
You must be doing something right then.
You would think that with all this need for new ideas and new acts on television, that you would be quite in demand because this is really coming from a different point of view.
It's novel
to a degree. But yet, have you been invited to any television or radio shows other than Race and Reason?
We've been contacted by one very asinine individual with the local station here because he wouldn't let me bring seat my supporters there. I turned him down. I don't really feel it would serve my purpose to be made a total fool of by this man who's interviewed you and has interviewed Tom.
No names.
But the point is that the big networks have not beat a path to your door. I mean, you know, if you had a three-headed dog, they'd be there. Well, what do you envision? Let's say Mexico. What's happening in Mexico? I mean, just coming at it from a white Hispanic position, our fat cats in Washington don't seem to want to seal the border and keep the mestizo population out. Well, what do you see happening? You know, how long can we be the open valve to relieve the Mexican government's problem? And what position would your group take in Mexico?
Well, our group in Mexico, as in other places where whites are a minority, we are white separatists. We favor possibly a separate nation state, a separate community of white people, whereby our people are able to preserve, maintain our culture, our biological and spiritual identity, and not be harassed by both mestizos as well as self-hating whites who basically rule the government into destroying us as a people, destroying our Christian names, our culture. We aren't against other races, other people. We just want to, like other races, we just want to survive as a people. And there's many theories, many ways discussed of how to do that. But
well, Pedro, did you see this as actually forming a separate nation within a nation? As like, say, as far as the white Mexicans forming, getting like a little part of Mexico for their own, or do you see it as one big confederation in a separate country of all different nationalities? How do you see that developing?
I think most people in our organization in Mexico would be happy with some type of autonomous state within the Confederation of Mexico, as long as we could exist as such. There's
totally separate from the Mexican
government.
Didn't
we go through this once at a place called Texas in the Alamo, where white people wanted just an autonomous state, and they were very willing to live under the Mexican government as long as they were given liberty and they weren't paying more taxes than other people? They ended up having to fight and then separating. Aren't we to the point maybe where one day we'll have to trade the mestizos that are up here for the Aryans who are in Mexico?
Yes, that's a possibility.
People there would like to migrate up here.
Yeah, I see that possibly as another solution as well as could be applied to South Africa, you know, send the American blacks to South Africa in exchange for the white South Africans. I think that situation, that solution could be applied to Mexico and very workable.
But I don't think Terre Blanche down there with the Afrikaners would go along with that, because he seems to be a fighter. That's the problem. You got so many people who want to hang on, and that's good. That's going to be pretty hard to convince them to make a trek and go to another continent.
Well, we'll have to talk.
It's the big struggle.
We have people in Mexico too that feel the same way, that would like to have a white minority, you know, rule over the entire republic. Mexico and South Africa have interesting parallels. That whites are the same, about the same percentage of the population, 14 to 20% of both Mexico and South Africa. The difference was, whites lost control of Mexico, whereas they were able to maintain control of South Africa. Now, had whites been able to maintain control of Mexico, you would see Mexico as the quote-unquote international fear.
Don't you see that as a fallacy, though, the Aryan race trying to rule over non-white people? Isn't it better that we just split the sheets and go our separate ways and have our independent republics?
I would agree that's the only plausible, workable solution at this point. I think that whites, first of all, are a very small minority on the entire globe, and I think we do have to, as you would say, sit down and work with people of other races and divide our own territories, our own
I don't think anything else will work, realistically. I mean, everything else has been tried but that, so at least let's give it a try.
And we know the same old political game. It doesn't seem to work too well.
Yeah, it's... Sedati is not a, quote-unquote, hate or violence-prone organization. We love our own people, and because we love our own people, we believe in standing up for our people at any cost. At times, that runs contrary to the interest of other peoples, other racial groups. At times, it coincides with their interests. But we like it all times possible to work with people of other races. The interest of our race, and they work in the interest of
their
race.
Well, sounds like we got a buddy here, huh? What do you
think? Sounds like it, Tom.
It's been good to have you with us, Pedro.
Yeah, I'm much honored to appear on this program, the only such program of its kind where such views can be disseminated to the public.
The only one in the world, as far as I know.
Freedom of speech.
And thank you out there, and remember, my friends, freedom of speech.